Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sarah Anderson of the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines the link between President Trump's assassination of an Iranian general, the threat of war, and the subsequent spike in stock prices of U.S. military contractors. Garrett Reppenhagen, Executive Director of Veterans for Peace, who explains why he believes the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq should immediately end and the Trump regime's threat of a new war with Iran is unconscionable. And Sunrise Movement organizer, high school senior Saya Ameli Hajebi, who discusses the next climate strike on the 50th anniversary of Earth Day on April 22nd and the group's strategy to impact the debate on climate change in the 2020 presidential election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In 2007, the United States began its campaign of precision airstrikes in Somalia, targeting the Islamic insurgent group Al-Shabaab and, more recently, ISIS. Over the past 3 years, the Pentagon says it has carried out over 148 airstrikes, killing between 900 and 1,000 people. The U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM, long maintained that all those killed in the attacks were targeted terrorists. Last year, Amnesty International investigated 6 U.S. airstrikes and concluded they caused 17 civilian casualties. AFRICOM has since admitted that one of their attacks did result in 2 civilian deaths. A recent investigation conducted by In These Times reporter Amanda Sperber found that U.S. airstrikes in Somalia have damaged farms, homes, and livestock. Strikes have also created a climate of uncertainty and paranoia within the communities they hit, as civilians start suspecting each other of being targeted members of Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab has reacted to the strikes by harassing villagers, accusing locals of being U.S. spies, or forcing them to choose between fighting for Al-Shabaab or fleeing their homes. U.S. airstrikes have boosted recruitment for ISIS and the Taliban, and experts say Al-Shabaab is using them in much the same way. Rosalind Omondi, the Associate Director of Research at the Horn Institute in Nairobi, Kenya, told Public Radio International that airstrikes feed into Al-Shabaab's claim that it is defending their country against foreign invaders. Sadia Ali Adan, a humanitarian and activist, told In These Times, "By all accounts, the U.S. Al-Shabaab-based policy in Somalia is a failure. Though many of their leaders are killed, Al-Shabaab is more lethal today than ever before." In the Democratic Party presidential nomination campaign, attention has recently begun to focus on Vice President Joe Biden's strong support of an anti-consumer bankruptcy law passed by Congress in 2005. Biden backed credit card companies based in his native Delaware by including in the legislation limits on consumer rights during bankruptcy. The law prevents students from seeking protection from onerous student loans, while it permits the wealthy to exploit the system to hide their assets from creditors. Presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren, Democratic senator from Massachusetts, built her whole legal career investigating the failings of the U.S. bankruptcy system for working families. Now, in the final weeks before the Iowa caucuses, Warren has released a comprehensive bankruptcy reform plan that, though it doesn't mention Biden by name, is designed to challenge his record of selling out working families to benefit financial interests. Warren's proposal seeks to reverse the worst aspects of the 2005 bankruptcy bill, making it once again an equitable system where everyone can obtain a second chance. Adam Green of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, a surrogate for the Warren campaign, said of the plan, "When thinking about electability, it would be complete malpractice to nominate someone who conspired in back rooms for years with credit card lobbyists and voted for every corporate bankruptcy bill, Wall Street deregulation, and trade deals that voters hate. Green asserts that Biden would ironically cede the outsider mantle to a corrupt incumbent president. Progressive Democratic New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is proposing a bill to redefine the level of U.S. poverty that could move out of committee in coming weeks. AOC's Recognizing Poverty Act calls on federal agencies to review the resources required to pay for basic goods and services, including some new necessities, such as internet access, for the first time since 1963. According to the American Prospect, the current poverty line is $12,500 for an individual and $26,000 for a family of four, regardless of which part of the country they live in. By this definition, 38 million Americans currently live in poverty, with an additional 93 million more living close to poverty, according to the most recent census data from 2018. Ocasio-Cortez's bill does not set new income levels, but she estimated that the individual poverty line could rise as high as $38,000, more than three times the current level. This would vastly increase the number of Americans classified as poor. For context, a $15 an hour minimum wage translates into an annual salary of just above $30,000, which would be well under AOC's suggested poverty line. But the Trump regime is moving in the opposite direction, seeking to slash benefits for the poor by imposing the chained consumer price index. This method of calculating the rate of inflation would slash the number of Americans who qualify for assistance programs, including food stamps, Medicaid, and supplemental security income. After a decade of chained CPI, the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities estimates that hundreds of thousands of U.S. citizens would lose access to federal assistance, including removing 40,000 children from nutritional programs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The tragic chain of events that followed President Trump's order to assassinate Iranian General Qasem Soleimani at Baghdad's international airport culminated in Iran's admission that it had accidentally shot down a civilian Ukrainian airliner on January 8th, killing all 176 aboard. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau blamed the U.S. in part for the tragic loss of life, linking the apparent accident to the rise in tensions following the assassination of General Soleimani. President Trump and his administration's explanation for their decision to kill Soleimani, Iran's second most powerful official, have been inconsistent and incoherent. Mr. Trump and his national security officials have issued contradictory statements about how imminent a threat General Soleimani posed to the U.S. In a Fox News interview, the president said that Soleimani was planning attacks on four U.S. embassies. However, Defense Secretary Mark Esper directly contradicted the president when he told an interviewer that he didn't see specific intelligence indicating an imminent attack on multiple embassies. While neither the U.S. or Iran have benefited from President Trump's order to assassinate the Iranian general, which increased the threat of war, there is one sector that has: the military-industrial complex. Your reporter spoke with Sarah Anderson, director of the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Here she talks about her recent article titled, "The Threat of War Inflates Stockholdings of Military Contractor CEOs."
Yeah, well, I decided to look at the top five military contractors and look at how much the CEOs of those companies benefited just from that first day of trading after the news of the assassination of General Soleimani in Iraq hit the financial markets. Wall Street traders know that a war with Iran would mean more lucrative contracts for U.S. weapons makers, and so they drove up the value value of stock in these companies, and CEOs get so much of their compensation in the form of stock-based pay. And so I looked at how much stock they were holding in their companies and how much the value of that increased just in that first day of post-assassination trading. And what I found was that these five executives before the assassination had stock in their companies worth a combined $319 million. And by the closing bell the following day, the value of their combined shares had increased by $7 million just for these five people. I checked the markets right before I left work today and found out that the value has continued to inch up after that real spike that first day. And it is so important, I think, to look at this because this creates a profit motive for war. And I don't think we should have to sit here right now in this very scary time where we really don't know where things are going to go with Iran and have to worry that might be a factor, that the personal profit motives of executives like these five could be part of what is driving this march to war.
And Sarah, before we run out of time, I did want to ask you about some alternative ways that contracts could be awarded to avert war profiteering.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you talked about in your article was a proposal to deny federal contracts to corporations that pay their top executives excessively. What would that look like? And you can review for us proposals from Vermont Senator and presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, and the late Senator John McCain of Arizona also had a proposal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I pointed out John McCain. When he was running for president as a Republican in 2008, that was the time of the financial crisis, and he came out with the idea of capping CEO pay at bailout companies that were receiving taxpayer dollars in that context. And he thought it would make sense to not allow them to make more than the American president's salary, which was about $400,000. And I think that general principle of having companies that rely on taxpayer money not have unlimited amounts of pay going to the CEO is something that should be extended to contractors as well. And Senator Sanders has said that if he's president, he would actually use an executive order. He says he doesn't think he would need to go through Congress in order to crack down on excessive pay among contractors. And the plan he has out there would cap CEO pay at no more than 150 times the median worker pay at that company, which, I think most people would think that kind of ratio would be pretty reasonable. So I think that, you know, the main point here is just to remind people that this is our money. We should have a say over it. We shouldn't have to watch so much of it flowing into the pockets of these CEOs. And the worst part of that is that it creates a profit motive that can be part of the pressure to escalate the conflict.
Well, Sarah, before we say goodnight, say a word about what the citizens' role should be here in advocating for the regulation of war profiteering. What can people do mm-hmm. to have an impact here?
Yeah, well, I know that there is going to be coordinated actions on January 25th to demand no war with Iran. You can find out about actions around the country and the world. And one place I know you can find out about protests in your area is on the website of Code Pink, so codepink.org. And I think that at the same time that the immediate thing is no war with Iran, but we should also use this really scary time with this chaotic approach to Iran and all of the increased tensions as an educational moment about the problem of war profiteering. And at the same time that we're saying no war with Iran, why don't we also say no more war profiteering either?
That was Sarah Anderson, Director of the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-editor of the IPS website, inequality.org. Find a link to Anderson's recent article and more analysis and commentary on the unfolding U.S.-Iran crisis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the past 2 weeks, President Donald Trump has escalated the threat of war with Iran by killing Iranian military commander Qasem Soleimani with an unmanned drone in Baghdad, deploying 3,000 more U.S. troops to Iraq, and imposing new harsher sanctions against Iran. In response to President Trump's assassination of General Soleimani, the Iraqi parliament voted to demand that all U.S. troops leave their country. President Trump then threatened severe sanctions against Iraq if the government expelled American troops. For some insight into how U.S. veterans view this latest escalation, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Garrett Reppenhagen, Executive Director of Veterans for Peace. He's a U.S. Army war veteran, having served in Iraq as an Army scout and sniper in the 1st Infantry Division from 2004 to 2005, arguably the most violent period of the U.S. war in that country. Before taking his current position, Reppenhagen served as the chairman of the board of Iraq Veterans Against the War and worked for other veterans organizations. Here he explains why these latest developments clearly puts the lie to the reasons U.S. military recruits were told they were fighting in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, I know it's a non-binding vote by the parliament in Iraq, but I was told a lot while I was serving in the Middle East that I was serving to help support and bring about democracy in that country. And it seems just when they've established a democracy that U.S. goes and ignores the vote and the decisions by that governing body. So it almost feels like the last false reason why I went to Iraq in the first place was just suddenly dissolved. There's a lot of service members that are scratching their heads wondering why we're still in Afghanistan, why we're still in Iraq, why we're in these multiple countries, and if it's necessary to escalate conflict with Iran. It's a difficult situation for our U.S. military. And it's the worst situation for the people in Iraq and Iran. It's the one thing that isn't in the conversation very often, I think, when Americans are talking, is the massive damage and destruction and death that's going to be part of these communities, communities that don't necessarily support their governments and are looking for peaceful ways outside of conflicts. They're always the ones that are going to be brutalized in indiscriminate and in immoral war. They should be the ones, I think, in a large extent, that folks are listening to, because they don't want these conflicts. They also don't want U.S. sanctions, and they don't want all these things that are being imposed upon them. So it's a very scary time to be to live in the Middle East.
I'm just wondering how these never-ending wars have impacted the number of U.S. Americans enlisting, since we still don't have a draft.
There are also reports coming out now about recruitment. In fact, last year's numbers, they were so far behind their enlistment goals, the recruitment goals, they were offering up to $40,000 enlistment bonus for infantry soldiers. So, you know, some of the most dangerous jobs are obviously the least wanted. And now the recruitment numbers, most of the people that are getting recruited now come almost disproportionately from military communities, if not from, you know, the most vulnerable parts of our society. The poorest and people of color and people in bad economic situations are involved in an economic draft. So where you see a large peer support for the military, people who are familiar with the military service and are surrounded by the glorification of the U.S. military in war, you see people like that joining the military and people who absolutely are the most needy that need opportunities to join as well. So, but the recruitment numbers are still very, very down from what they have been in previous years.
I know after 9/11, at least based on the photos of the dead that were published in newspapers, the people signing up were majority white. Are you saying that's changed?
A larger percentage than it used to be. You're still going to see a reflection of our society as a whole going into the military, but there's higher numbers of people of color than there were in the past.
And a question for you, Garrett Reppenhagen. You obviously were surrounded by military people in your family, but why did you enlist?
It's certainly economic. I was a high school dropout. My father passed away of Agent Orange-related cancer when I was in high school. It led me to eventually dropping out of high school myself, just having a very difficult time being poor in America, working three, sometimes four jobs, sleeping in my car very often. I needed a way to get into college and feel like I've earned my seat at the table, basically. Yeah, I decided to join 1 month before September 11th.
What is the position of Veterans for Peace on this latest escalation?
It's obvious this administration is pushing us further and further to the edge of war and very conventional war, even though we've been at war with many countries through drone operations, through special forces operations and other military activity. But drawing us closer to this large conventional war is extremely scary, and it's pointless. You know, it's something that's not inevitable, that is avoidable. And withdrawing from the nuclear deal, you know, making these strikes that defy another country's sovereignty, all the talking points of really violent rhetoric from our national leader really, really is frightening. And, you know, it jeopardizes the lives of our troops, and it jeopardizes the lives and well-being of many people all throughout the world. We reject it. We oppose it. We see that, you know, the recent reveal of the Afghanistan papers, of the mismanagement of the Afghanistan conflict, just show us that we're not capable of managing these conflicts very well. It's a waste of resources. It's a waste of taxpayer money, and it's a waste of life. And we reject it as Veterans for Peace.
That was Garrett Reppenhagen, Executive Director of Veterans for Peace. Learn more about Veterans for Peace and their campaign to end America's endless wars by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The youth-led Sunrise Movement, founded in April 2017, first came to the attention of the nation when 200 climate activists occupied incoming Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office 1 week after the 2018 midterm elections. The group demanded that House Democrats establish a committee to draft a Green New Deal. Newly elected Democratic New York Congresswoman and radical firebrand Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez joined in the group's sit-in and supported their demands. Although the House Democratic leadership never formed such a committee, Sunrise went on to organize 200 town hall meetings across the U.S. to promote the Green New Deal. Today, the group continues to pressure politicians to support the Green New Deal's concept of funding an urgent campaign to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, while also addressing the nation's record level of income inequality. Most Democratic presidential candidates now either support the Green New Deal or largely agree with its vision, if not its price tag. Your reporter spoke with Saya Ameli Hajebi, a high school senior and leader of the Sunrise Movement in Boston, Massachusetts. Ameli, who had lived in Iran and came to the U.S. 8 years ago, discusses the next climate strike on the 50th anniversary of Earth Day on April 22nd and the group's strategy to impact the debate on climate change in the 2020 presidential election.
These strikes were originally started by Greta Thunberg in Sweden, but they've kind of taken over the world because there's this need and there's this want for youth activism and climate action. It's easy for a lot of us to feel like we're the only ones who care or the only ones who want to do something, but these strikes are bringing people together from all different walks of life and proving that our power together can change things in the government and change things for our communities. My team of strike organizers started about a month ago after the December 6th strike. And we've already begun putting our team structures together. We've already begun our meetings. And in fact, our team is made up of high schoolers and college freshmen, all under 20 years old. And at first, people really didn't think that we could do it. There were a lot of even adult allies telling us that taking on a strike was too ambitious of a project for young people to take on. But on September 20th, we actually gathered over 10,000 people in Boston for the strike. And on December 20th, we shook the Massachusetts State House with the power of our voices, and we're going to do that on a much, much larger scale on April 22nd this year. And it's absolutely crucial that we do that because this election in 2020 is going to be perhaps the most important of our lifetimes. because we need to make sure that we elect the president who's going to stand up for the people of America and not the fossil fuel companies of America.
Saya, what are the central demands of this strike coming up on April 22nd?
We're demanding that the government declare a climate emergency. We're demanding that the Green New Deal gets signed into law. And we're demanding to go fossil fuel free. And solutions and policies are already proposed. They just need to be turned into law and put in place.
Saya, I did want to ask you about some of the work you're doing around the 2020 presidential election. When we talked earlier, you reminded me that I believe the Sunrise Movement has endorsed Bernie Sanders for president, if I'm not mistaken. And maybe you could talk about why you chose Bernie Sanders as your candidate and the kinds of actions that you plan to engage in from now through the election this November.
Absolutely. You know, a couple weeks ago, Sunrise actually came out with presidential scorecards. So just like the same way that I'm graded on how well I know calculus, we graded the presidential candidates on how well they were going to address the climate crisis through their policies. And Senator Sanders and Senator Warren scored the highest. Then we took a vote across our whole movement from Sunrisers all across the country, and it was overwhelmingly decided that we wanted to endorse Bernie Sanders. And that's what we have done, and that's what we're going to put our full force behind, making sure that he is the one who wins the nomination and ultimately the presidency, because he has worked very closely with our movement, and his policy is the most ambitious thus far in addressing the climate crisis. And we can't have anything less but a Green New Deal, and just as ambitious as his policy right now.
That was Saya Ameli-Hajebi, a high school senior and leader of the Sunrise Movement in Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more about the Sunrise Movement and the April 22nd climate strike by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRPI in Ithaca, New York, WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, KRBX in Boise, Idaho, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.